is a day in September of 1965 when I joined SDS in Champaign, Illinois, University of Illinois. And I saw a pamphlet on the SDS table with registration, and it cost a quarter. And that pamphlet was the Port Huron Statement. Now, I'd been in local civil rights activities, such as they were, and read all the sort of radical theory I put my hands on and was writing an honors thesis on an obscure piece of American socialist history, so I thought I was a sophisticated fellow of the left. But when I read this pamphlet, it turned my own political world upside down. It was more radical in its way than anything I read so far from all those mostly European sources. And it must have reminded me of my great-grandfather, the former abolitionist who marched with Sherman to Georgia. At any rate, the Port Huron Statement was authored in a way, although it was a collective document, by Tom Hayden, and it was a manifesto for our generation. What are the other things that we remember about Tom Hayden? I sound like I'm speaking about him in the past. It's mostly my past we remember. He was a central figure in early SDS, and it's hard to think that SDS would have risen to the 100,000 supporters and influence on many campuses, certainly including this one, without the early leadership that he provided. By 1968, he was an important figure in the Democratic Party struggle over the Chicago Convention. That same year, he was also a pallbearer for Robert Kennedy. He went to Vietnam, carried on a tour later, a national tour with Jane Fonda, attracting an enormous amount of anti-war energy and animus, one might say. And shifted his base to California, where he helped form, I would say, what was called the Soviet Republic of Santa Monica. It may not be a Soviet Republic anymore. And went on to several long terms in the California state legislature, from 1982 elected and from 1992 in the state Senate, in which he carried out a campaign, sometimes by himself alone. He was sort of a Robert La Follette kind of character who wasn't at all shy or embarrassed to be the only person in the legislature to take a moral position on things. And he also played a big role in things like Big Green, an ecological initiative that was overwhelmed by big business but showed a marker towards where progressive movements were going to have to go in the late 20th and 21st century. He just happens to have written quite a number of books, and the most recent one, which he asked me to pump very hard in front of you, is Ending the War in Iraq. I want to grab my copy, my heavily annotated copy, because he says a lot of stuff in here analyzing the war, analyzing the nature of the neoconservative and what we used to call corporate liberal support of the war and unwillingness to end the war. But he really is making an appeal to the heart and soul of American life. And he says, I'll quote briefly, "Americans must learn that the deepest causes of the war lie in the actions of our domestic institutions. It's not about blaming America, but taking responsibility for the role in our institutions play in creating the predicaments we face." Well, he goes on to say, in the spirit of our great Madison professor, William Appleman Williams, that Americans can and must leave empire behind. And ends by coming back to the 1960s. I would say perhaps the most important thing in this book is the argument that the social movements of the 1960s did help to end the war, and that tremendously important piece of American political history must be returned to it. He says that in order to proceed, there must be a vast awakening of the kind that happened briefly and brightly in the late 60s before it flickered out amidst assassinations too unbearable and reforms too limited, a wonderful turn of phrase there. The reforms of the 60s have nevertheless led to new understanding, new underlying norms, openings in institutions, and opportunities for globalizing democracy that can inform, energize, and propel social movements to greater possibilities. Perhaps because I spent the years since the 60s primarily in social movements, my opinion is the movements are always the point of departure for real change, but need to incorporate outside-inside strategies as they grow. The right to know and participate, the core demand of the 60s, has been largely accepted in this society. It's no accident that neoconservatives believe wars like Iraq must be conducted off the, so to speak. The greatest threats to neoconservatives, the Pentagon, the multinational corporations, and the White House come not from caves in faraway countries, but from the gathering force of the American people. So please greet Tom Hayden.
Thanks, Paul, very much for all that you've done for many decades. And I'm glad to be here in this room once again. I've been here many times since the, I believe it was the August of 1960, when I was wonderstruck by Madison, not so much by the beauty of the lake or the community, but by the gathering of students who were there to hear the leaders of the nonviolent civil disobedience movement up from Mississippi give mesmerizing speeches that started to turn the generation around. I also want to recognize my old friend and your perpetual leader in conscience, Paul Soglin, for being here, and I can't imagine who else I will notice in a couple of minutes. But enough nostalgia. I wanted to also thank the people of the good folks that brought me here, and draw notice to the Liberty Tree Foundation, the small D democratic organization that I serve on as a lapsed member of the advisory board, and the coming of Francis Moore LePay, who deserves even a bigger leaflet than this. And what else? On October 27th, not but a week from now, I don't know what will be happening in Madison, but I know that 50 buses of people from black churches on the south side of Chicago are converging to lend a hand with the ongoing protests against the war in Iraq, which are happening in a number of cities around the country, including New Orleans, where there may be 10,000 people. So there's a diversity of demonstrations that are happening to try to keep the existence of this movement front and center. I know that this has been a week of concentration on memory, and it may be duplicative for me to just add to it, but I teach as well as engage in social movements. I teach sociology at the Pitzer College, and the Claremont Chain, and Occidental College. And I teach from my experience, but I've also done quite a bit of sifting and winnowing, trying, as you would say in Wisconsin at the university, into the ups and downs of social movements in our history and their nature. And I've tried to summarize them in little charts and diagrams for my students. So it's not exactly a hot slideshow that you see here, but you may be able to follow some of what I'm saying, because I want to try to leave an impression that there is a pattern. A lot of people think the universe is utterly random. Even the random has a pattern. And if we don't locate ourselves in patterns, it's very difficult for us to feel that we count for anything. So I want to talk about that. The context of the week is about memory of 1967. And I think social movements both begin and end in memory, in cycles of memory. And there are sort of three schools of thought about memory, whether it's the memory of Tao or any other social movements. One school seeks to eulogize the movements of the past so as to pass on a legacy to the younger generation. They struggle with or for curriculum reform. They struggle for media coverage. They hold ceremonial events on certain days to commemorate what happened. They try to create a lauric landscape, a whole American landscape that has stories in it, and locations that are filled with great traditions. On the other hand, there are people, and I'll get to them in a couple of minutes, who would like nothing better than to wipe out any trace of what happened in 1967 or in the 1960s. They want to start anew. They want to forget the past. They want to make sure that there are no martyrs, no examples, no legacies that can give strength to future generations. There's a middle group, which are usually the people who are in power, who had nothing to do with the events in question, but realize that it's an issue to be managed. And so these are the memory managers, the museum managers, who try to cull and select a kind of safe and responsible memory of what happened in order to show the triumphant nature of the American culture in overcoming obstacles. And they usually assign credit for the reforms and achievements of the past to the establishment of the past. So this struggle seems to me in old age, and actually when I was very young, to be preeminent. And it's a struggle for our minds, but it has to do also with our actions. The translation of memory into action is much more important than simply remembering in itself. I divide the 60s into two stories, the first 60s and the second 60s. The first 60s, I believe, is the context for the second, obviously. You had a lot of concentration this week on what happened in 1967, but probably people have told you, and it needs to be repeated here, that the events of 1967 can only be understood in the context of the decision by our government, which then was led by a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, to invade Vietnam and therefore invade us with their violence, and to send suddenly over 100,000 conscripted American soldiers to Vietnam after promising not to in the short period between November 64 and the spring of 1965, when the first SDS national demonstration against the war was held. But these events were preceded by the difficult to explain flowering of a student movement across the country, largely inspired by the black student movement in the South. It was a time also of nuclear dread. There were two occasions in which the nuclear weapons almost went off during our young lives, Berlin and Cuba. And it was a time also of watching a young president and his brother adjust from being centrists and pragmatists to having to find ways to respond to, keep up with, and give some support to these stirrings for civil rights, student rights, the Peace Corps, preventing the expansion of the war in Vietnam, and above all, ending the Cold War nuclear arms race. All this was occurring in the time between my senior year and the death of John Kennedy, a three-year period that is worth dwelling on in the struggle for memory. And it was also a time that people forget there was also evidence of a cultural explosion that was obvious in the books and writings Evelyn Williams had written earlier. He became a hero of mine and many in the early SDS. But just during those same few years, I was making some notes tonight. You had Michael Harrington's The Other America, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed, John Kenneth Galbraith's The Affluent Society, just before that, Allen Ginsberg's Powell, in my senior year in high school, On the Road by Jack Kerouac. All of this in a 3 to 5 year period, a flowering of literature, progressive literature that had not been seen in America since the 1840s. Maybe during the height of the New Deal. Quite extraordinary, and it remains for somebody to explain it. I can't. My explanation is that social movements arise in mysterious circumstances, not because of objective conditions, but because of subjective feelings. And they are never predicted by themselves. They are never predicted by professors. They are never predicted by experts or by journalists. They are then codified after they happen. So it's not surprising to me, having seen it over and over. They don't even begin with organizations. They begin in seemingly spontaneous pre-organizational forms that are influenced by the legacies and ideas of organizations that have been long forgotten. That's the context. Into this early sense of our future came the first shock, which I identify as the assassination of John Kennedy in 63. Others could locate it elsewhere. And then the second shock was the experience of having, for the first time that our generation could remember, a president who was a naked liar, an obscene liar, because he was trafficking in human life. He was promising not to send troops to Southeast Asia, while at the same time preparing the war machinery so that he could launch the ground war almost immediately after his own election. These things weigh heavily on you when you are 22 or 23 years old. Now, I suppose we have the opposite problem, people thinking all politicians lie. I know people who always vote for the politician that sounds the worst because they think what the liberals do is deceive you. The conservatives will surprise you. Nixon will go to China, but a Democrat would never do that, and so on and so forth. So we have now a context of utter disdain for the deceit of the political order, and it's difficult to remember that there was a time when it was sort of shocking to young people who couldn't vote but could hope. It was shocking that a candidate for president would lie about his intentions of sending hundreds of thousands of young Americans to a war. So the second shot, gave us this sense that it was also more than the elected government being a government that could deceive you. The elected government was paralleled by kind of a shadow state that you could never make accountable. There were contractors. There were universities. There were classified realms, documentary realms, vaults, archives, personnel, secret operations, commandos. The discovery that people like C. Wright Mills knew what they were talking about when they described power elites. So the whole idea of participatory democracy became quite deep when we realized that it was more than elections, although they were important. It was trying to uncover, expose, and then somehow hold accountable a secretive government of manipulators in both the private and public sectors. And all of them were agents of deception of one kind or another. As I recall, Dow Corporation explained its contracts to do Napalm and Agent Orange as merely playing the role of, quote, simple good citizenship. It took researchers, it took hard work on this campus to figure all of this out. The same with Columbia and other campuses. The that period, 64-65, was really marked by the escalation of the war in Vietnam, and it launched the what I call the second 60s. And this is where the events in Madison, Berkeley, Columbia, and Yale, all these campuses took place in the context of the second 60s. And I can simplify it, but the second 60s was about the realization that we had been misled and were fantasizing the hopes of the early 60s, or so we thought. We went from an experience of thinking like Quakers that you needed to speak truth to power to a new logic, a pervasive logic that came down to saying you have to find a way to speak power to power because power wasn't listening to facts or arguments. And how could we, who seemed so powerless, begin to develop a power that could offset the silent power and the unreachable power? And from there it would evolve into conceptions of resistance, both reasonable and esoteric, but the shift was made possible by the decision of our establishment to start the war in Vietnam, which meant ignoring Mississippi and even ignoring the budding anti-poverty movements. To personalize it, I thought that we could prevent the war from expanding. Kennedy would live and somehow we would get him to end it, or Johnson would end it. I had already packed my things. I was moving like as only a young person can think of this way. I was moving to Newark. I'd never been to Newark. But I was going to go to the Newark ghetto and knock on doors and build block organizations and out of them neighborhood organizations, and we were going to empower the powerless people in Newark, just as they were doing in Mississippi. And SDS was going to do this in 10, 20, 30, 40 cities. And we were going to develop a movement, black, brown, and white, rural, urban, ghetto, barrio, that would have the power to contend for at least a place at the table in the future argument over how to implement a real war on poverty. Vietnam was the farthest thing from my mind. It was there like an irritation. I say that to get you to understand that the invasion of Vietnam was experienced by people like me as an invasion of my life. I had committed my life to one direction. I now had to readjust and recommit and basically give up on being able to do anything successful about the racial gap and the poverty gap, because all the resources and all the attention was being drained away to this war in a place that none of us had ever seriously heard of or spent time considering. So there was this whole wrenching effect. Even if you weren't drafted, you were wrenched out of your plans for your own future into somebody else's plans for you. And I think that added to this sense that that we had to find some counterforce that was greater than the Port Huron statement or mere words. It was probably put best by a person who came back from the Mississippi Freedom Summer to Berkeley, where the free speech movement was beginning, Mario Savio. And I think of his words as probably the greatest words of the 1960s student generation. I take that back. You can't really compare it to other words, but these were noble words. I believe these were spontaneous words, and you know them well. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, it makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part
And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. Now, how did this sentiment come about? I think I've tried to explain it, but let me restate it. If you're caught between the urgency you feel, having been bombed in Mississippi, and seeing people napalmed and bombed every day, every minute of every day in Vietnam, there's an urgency that's different than how you might feel about intractable poverty. It's an urgency that requires a continual escalation as more and more violence goes off. And the violence is not out there. The violence is close to your heart. The violence is invading you. Fanon would write about how the indigenous people became violent because colonialism was violent inherently. One step removed, perhaps, but a similar process was happening on these campuses. And the other side of this feeling of urgency was that you couldn't do anything about the slow snail pace of the American people, your fathers and mothers who just didn't get it, the Democrats who just didn't get it, the people that actually wanted you to be drafted to teach you a lesson, wanted you to go to Vietnam so you would grow up. They just didn't get it. So were you to be a gradualist and wait forever for these people to wake up while more and more people died? Or were you to become a militant and try to escalate your protest to a level consistent with the suffering that you knew was going on? It was an unresolvable dilemma. It was not an abstract choice. It was a dilemma being presented by the experience that we were going through. That's how I would explain it. And it was not just the free speech movement, not just Madison. We know that. But there was this chain reaction. When social movements take off, they sometimes, you almost need to reach for natural analogies to explain them, or chemical analogies. It's a chain reaction. Suddenly, you have Madison followed by 100,000 people at the Pentagon, scaring the establishment to death, snipers on the roof of the Pentagon. That was the model for what Chicago was supposed to be in 68. Then you had immediately after that the Columbia strike and 100 similar Columbias. Columbia got all the attention because it sort of belonged intellectually to the New York Times and it was on the front page every day. The publisher of the Times was a trustee, of course. But there were many, many, many Columbia universities all at once, all started seemingly by action factions, they were called, small cadres of students who simply seized the time in the Panther rhetoric, and I found myself chairing an occupied building, a mathematics building at Columbia University, across from which my 34-year-old son was just married in an elegant ceremony recently. And you had that followed by the murders of King and Kennedy, the murders in the ghettos. I had gone through Newark, 1967, 26 killed in 5 days, hundreds wounded, thousands arrested, 5 day period. It was my task to collect the eyewitness accounts to each and every killing. I had to immerse myself in this bloodbath and interview immediately, while the evidence was fresh, the stories of the victims' mothers, fathers, grandfathers, sons, daughters, friends, and so on. I don't have to tell you about Chicago. Chicago just sort of entered the vocabulary. If you don't know what Chicago means, you weren't there. So we went through 5 days of similar treatment and similar abuse in Chicago that August, then after Chicago, the Chicago trial, the murders of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, then Kent State, then Jackson State, then more student strikes, then May Day, 15,000 demonstrators corralled in a stadium, all in a 2 or 3 year period, 4 year period. And then it all suddenly began to end. It was a very unsettling and destabilizing experience to feel it unraveling and ending. The thing that you hadn't really controlled to begin with was now out of your control and was fading. And there are some, perhaps here, who think that it was our own extremisms that brought the 60s to an end. And they make an interesting case. You know, the beatings by the Hell's Angels, who were held up as icons by some of the hippies, the beatings by the Hell's Angels of the black man at Altamont while Mick Jagger was singing Sympathy for the Devil, the Manson family madness, the horrific result of the math building bombing here, the townhouse explosion in which three former young friends of mine in SDS blew themselves up while actually constructing an anti-personnel bomb for use on uncertain enemies. These were moral disasters. These were political disasters. I don't disagree with that at all. But I don't hold with the analysis that the 60s died of this overdose of excesses or overdose of overdoses or innocence and idealism died of our own doing. Again and again I hear, innocence died, and you fill in the blank. And that was the end of the 60s. I think a much more sound explanation, one that doesn't necessarily appeal to historians or journalists necessarily, is that the 60s ended because the 60s, to a large extent, succeeded. The 60s ended because the 60s succeeded. What happens is you'll go from the margins down here, the lower line, to the mainstream, and when you enter the mainstream, your numbers increase, and eventually there's a core, a majority in favor of your core demands, your original demands. Maybe you've escalated your demands. We don't know how that goes. But your core demands now have majority support. At that point, it's inevitable that in some fashion you will succeed, but at the same time, know that the Machiavellians, what you used to call the power elites, are doing, are giving the concession because they have decided that it's the only way to restore order, a reformed order, but a restoration of order. And so people demobilize after they succeed. That's why the 60s ended. People didn't join 60s movements in order to go to meetings every night like this for the rest of their lives. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the American culture. And so in the brilliant analysis of my partner from SDS, Richard Flax, is a retired professor in Santa Barbara, helped write the Port Huron Statement, when movements succeed, their rank and file followers return to private everyday lives that they came from for the exact reason that they want to enjoy the satisfactions and the benefits of the success of the movement. If the movement has made their personal lives better, their everyday life better, that's something that we should be happy for and proud of. Now, a few discontents, like myself, we become, I mean, I wasn't a leftist, I didn't know what that was. I became involved on these moral issues, but by then, I was certain that I saw an entire manipulative Machiavellian system behind all of these transgressions and invasions, and I had to end the system. I couldn't be satisfied with voting rights or something like that. The system had to go. There's always people like that, and God bless them. But they have to recognize that they become somewhat stranded after the original goals are achieved. You have to wait for the next wave. And there's others, a subgroup of the few, who see opportunities in public life, perhaps Paul did, opportunities in public life that weren't there before the movement. And they go into politics or into sort of the professionalization of reform. They become the advocates on the inside of government agencies or civic networks. And they too have a role to play. They too are stranded because their base is ebbing. And now what happens over here on the above is the people that never, ever supported the reform, the no surrender, the no give in people, they are even more hysterically agitated because now the Supreme Court has legalized reproductive rights. And they believe that that's immoral, it's against God's will, and they have to take extreme measures to try to repel the new reformed social order. So the movement demobilizes to enjoy the benefits in everyday life. The people that were entirely against these reforms become more animated, and they start to attack and pick away at the achievements of the movement in a process that I think is easy to explain and is inevitable. Now, let me just go back to one point here, because it may have struck me that I kind of passed over the argument that the 60s succeeded. And I think this point has to be drilled in, and I invite any counter-argument. I've never found one. What people do is they forget. When I say the 60s succeeded, I mean this. Voting rights for Southern blacks, 20 million people. Voting rights for students, 18 to 21-year-olds in general, 7 million people. 27 million people enfranchised with voting rights who were disenfranchised before the 60s. The end of the wars in Indochina. The end of the draft, congressional checks on the imperial presidency, on the CIA, and on the FBI, the Freedom of Information Act, tougher environmental, consumer, and health laws than anything passed since, including the clean air, clean water, endangered species, and OSHA provisions, media fairness doctrine, 1973 Roe v. Wade, all right, it's 3 years after the 60s, but it's a definite outcome of the 60s and the women's movement. Huge reforms of the curriculum, what's studied, what's read, what's tolerated in the high schools and college curriculums. Ethnic studies, women's studies, environmental studies, gay, lesbian studies, anything you want studies, things that you had to fight for in Berkeley through tear gas. You were now invited to come in for a cup of coffee and a conversation with a professor about Marx, no problem. Chomsky, no problem. Marcuse, repressive tolerance, yes, that's us. The university opened its curriculum under the force of social movements. Not because somebody woke up and said, geez, we left all these people out of the canon. We have to include them. It was like the greatest affirmative action push of all was the change of the content of education, higher education in particular. Freedom of sexual desire, decline of censorship, and not to mention the fall of two presidencies. A lot of things happened in the 1960s, or as a result of the 1960s. I'm not claiming that organizations accomplished this. I am claiming that the 60s uprising as a whole had these effects. And for a very long time, they have lasted, even as counter-movements have continually tried to chip away against them. I can understand why this is an unpopular thesis with, say, Dick Cheney and Lynn Cheney, who are stepping over bodies like Paul's on their way to statistical courses in sociology, thinking that they might be contaminated by the sight of of the Madison students are infected by the blood on the floor as they went on to their careers. But notice their careers. Even to this day, Cheney's driving mission in his political career is to roll back everything achieved in the 1960s and restore the imperial presidency without checks or balances, if possible. And he's doing quite well at it for a guy at 18% popularity. He is. Lynn Cheney, what was her entire career about until this moment? In whatever position she got, under Reagan in particular, it was to stamp this hideous label. Somebody should do research on where this label came from. It was not made up. Political correctness on every reform of the curriculum. She would issue speeches and pamphlets saying that it was a horrible thing for American society that more high school students knew who Harriet Tubman was than who was the commander-in-chief of the Revolutionary Army of the United States and then in the struggle against the British. It was a stupid question. Why would anybody know the answer to that? I'm sure more students knew George Washington's name than Tubman's. Bad social science. But it was a way of saying Harriet Tubman should be remembered, maybe, but in no way should be lifted to a level of more comprehension among young people than George Washington. The universities have been taken over by the latter-day social movement theoreticians and so on. And Brzezinski, after 68, Carter's security advisor, one of the bipartisan establishment people, actually said that all the riots and tumult and havoc of 1968 was merely the death rattle of historically irrelevant people. He was already pronouncing the 60s over, and he spent the subsequent 30 years of his life trying to drive that last nail into the coffin of the 60s. What bothers me more, I can understand why people who were on the losing end of that argument, the conservatives, would, you know, want to reverse it. But what puzzles me, and here, this is why I came to Madison to say this, what puzzles me are the radical thinkers and historians who come to the same conclusions from a different angle of the ideological spectrum. I have never said a bad word about Appleman Williams, Howard Zinn. These are icons. Jimmy Weinstein. But if you look at their writings, you see why intellectuals, for all of their gifts and contributions to us, are not always the best advisors as to what to do. In other words, their theories don't come from the experience of practice. They come from the experience of revising previous theories, or so would be my shorthand way of analyzing it. Here's what Appleman Williams said at the time, in the 70s, and I'm quoting, "Some people feel that ending the war in Vietnam and driving Nixon from office created a momentum for change." That would be me. But it is impossible to end the empire, either at home or abroad, by winning occasional dramatic victories, particularly when they are in truth but marginal victories, the removal of a president and the ending of 500,000 troops in Vietnam, a dramatic but marginal victory. The structural determinants of another imperial war and for another effort to consolidate total power remain essentially as strong as ever. Ending the war in Vietnam, 2 million dead, toppling two presidents, irrelevant because power was unchanged. That's the argument. My friend Howard Zinn, who I lived with in Atlanta during the civil rights movement, sit-in movement, and his book, People's History, is actually a perfect example of this chart that shows how radical ideas become mainstreamed. And one can hardly say that Zinn is the less fortunate for having succeeded in capturing a majority audience. He has very little to say if you read it carefully, and I teach his book every semester, so I read it even more carefully every semester. There's very little to say about anything positive in the way of reform in the entire history of the United States. The farmers of the Hudson Valley, well, they were, according to Howard, diverted into voting, which left the basic structure of rich and poor intact. The reforms of the Progressive Era, the La Follette Era here, were aimed at soothing protest. Winning the right to vote for women after 100 years, that didn't make much difference. The outcome of the New Deal, that was to preserve the capitalist system. The passage of laws banning child labor and establishing the 8-hour day, those were, quote, just enough to dull the edge of resentment, close quote. James Weinstein and a new generation of radical historians gave this system a name, which Paul Beal referenced, corporate liberalism, which absorbed all radicals and all revolutionaries and all their movements like a sponge. That was the image. No matter what you did, the sponge of power would absorb you. We in SDS, I think we definitely accepted that analysis because there was some truth in it. There's no question about there's some truth in it. But is it the whole truth, and how useful is a partial truth in this case? It did seem to distinguish our new radicalism from the older generation of left liberals. But I'm here to say, after 50 years of this, it's 50 years since I entered the university, and so 45 years of straight, nonstop, direct action, electoral politics, jails, you name it. I've tried everything, tried several times. I have reached this conclusion that is so simple, it may be hard for you to understand why I stress it. Real reform is good. Reform is good. History shows that it may be all we in America can expect. I'm not talking about lip service, window dressing, you know, that kind of superficial reform. I'm not talking about corporate branding. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about reforms that are deep enough to overturn a barrier or open a door or increase the empowerment of somebody who's previously without power, or redistribute resources and benefits, even if it's not a full redistribution, like the achievement of Medicare and Medicaid, defense of remaining wilderness, restoration of indigenous rights, reforms that make everyday life better for all of us, who, after all, have only one life to live. I think these reforms are to be appreciated as the lasting legacies of America's radical movements. They account for what makes life worth living for me. Simple things that you forget about all the time. It took Karl Marx to get us the idea of a vacation. You know, it wasn't Henry Ford. It wasn't the university's choice. It came out of revolutionary movements who settled on an 8-hour day because they wanted people to have leisure time to read. Karl Marx probably wanted them to read to go to more meetings, but from that came the revolution, and the threat of revolution were really the primary reasons that elites were forced to accept the reforms of capitalism of the last century. And to dismiss those, I have a hard time understanding. Full dismissal. We're talking about social democratic policies, family leave, 35-hour week in France, the veneration of the idea of working to live instead of living to work, all of these things that are still at stake in Europe today, but where you have labor parties, trade unions, advocacy organizations throughout civil society at the table. And the result of that is not a world that is the kind of world that I'm ready to declare myself a full citizenship of. But my point is that the history of revolution, even if we are revolutionaries, is one that makes reform necessary to the elites. And reform, on the other hand, makes classical revolution less likely. It's a rule. It just is. I'm not advocating it. I'm saying it. Let me clean myself. I do believe in the revolutionary process, probably more than anyone in this room. I have been there. I am there. I understand that our economic system promotes inequalities that are structural, that are permanent, requires the exploitation of resources, that the whole political model of political economy requires the destruction of resources into raw materials, kind of like nature being a storehouse for growth, and growth is then distributed unequally in a structural sense. There's no getting around the contours of the system. And I also believe this about the revolutionary process, that I believe that confrontation with an undemocratic power structure, state, corporation, university, is an essential experience in becoming a passionate and well-rounded human being. I believe all those things, but real reform should be never shrugged off. Real reform should be embraced. Real reform is the outcome of revolutionary struggles, and it's a disservice and a kind of disrespect to previous generations of radicals and revolutionaries to dismiss, say, 100 years of women's struggle for the right to vote as not meaning very much. Why? Because it would be better to avoid misleading them and go straight to communism or socialism or what? Bypass the trap of electoral politics. Don't delude anyone into thinking that they should vote. Go straight to, I'm waiting for the answer. These are not things that you can do anything about. That's my point. Some people argue that there must have been there was a better way. They were misled. The demands should have been different. But history is a cruel teacher. There is free will, but even free will is in the context of all kinds of winds of change that limit what you are doing. And what we see is, what I said earlier, we have an America that's in a transition and in a crisis. And we should honor the towns like Madison or Berkeley that dot the landscape as a result of the 60s, precisely because they're better places to live. Given the choice, we'd rather live there. The amenities are better. The services are better. The intellectual climate is more open. It's richer. And there's hundreds of these cities and towns that have spread as the poles, the centers of what is superficially called Blue America. Blue America, whatever that means, is half of America. So by this crude measure, social movements have come to change half of America. Is it enough? No, of course not. Is it something? I live in the middle of Los Angeles, which is the epicenter of the globalization crisis, the capitalism crisis, the immigration crisis, the racial crisis, the gangs crisis. Look, I live there because I want to fight the fight. I don't live there because it's a nice place to live. And I treasure the fact that we have a Mexican-American mayor in a city that used to be part of Mexico. It doesn't mean I think he goes far enough, no. But I treasure the fact that we are in a community where everyday life is about deciding on who's an immigrant and who's not, who stays, who belongs, whether workers get living wages or not, whether the Minutemen on the border will triumph over the Mexican immigrants or not, whether the megalopolis will destroy the environment or be restrained and reversed to get back to better air and so on. I feel like I'm not the barricades. I'm not in a community that's at an intense, continuous 30-year struggle the way Belfast the land of my ancestors is, has been, but I'm in a community that has meaning. I'm in a community that's different than other communities because of social movements. And I treasure that, and I try to tell myself every day when I get up, bitter with what has gone wrong, that this place is different because of the efforts of the left of the past and the civil rights movement and the farm workers movement and the environmental movements, and it has a long way to go. But that's what I mean by treasuring reform, because I know that my own life and my family's life is better. If Los Angeles was the way it was in the past, I don't know what I would choose to do. I don't know what I would do. And I think that having enough of these communities well-organized and vocal is sufficient to at least complicate the powers that be, complicate the empire, complicate the prosecution of the war in Iraq. Not big enough to end it or terminate it, but we are complicating it, and I'll get to that.